Hello, I'm Steve Davis. Welcome to this podcast for Australia's National Centre for Vocational Education Research. In May 2011, a series of Research on Toast breakfast briefings was held around Australia, focusing on insights arising from research into apprenticeships. The key researchers sharing these insights were Dr. Tom Carmel from NCVER, Professor Erica Smith from the University of Ballarat, and Dr. Damien Oliver, also from NCVER. They summarised findings from various research projects. Tom shed new light on ways to gain more accurate measurements of apprenticeship completion rates. Erica undertook analysis of the psychological contract in apprenticeships and traineeships, with a view to how better understanding of such contracts might lead to higher completion rates. And Tom and Damien explored whether pre-apprenticeships actually deliver on their promise of improved retention rates. They join me now to walk through their findings together. Tom, I'll start with you, if I may, because one of the dominant themes in any discussion about apprenticeships and traineeships is how many of the participants actually follow through, complete their training and move into employment. And would it be fair to say that what prompted your research into measuring apprenticeship completion rates was a suspicion that official data paints a picture that is bleaker than the reality?
Well, my interest is really in exploring our data and trying to understand it. The official data, the official completion rates are the ones that we publish, and we certainly stand behind them. But what I'm interested in is actually understanding what these data really mean and whether there are any shortcomings to them and whether we can look at this data in different ways.
And how do we calculate the completion rates officially compared to the methods you looked at?
Well, the official estimation method is to estimate the number of completions of people who started in a particular period of time. And so we can track these individuals through and we come up with a rate. The complication is that the entity that we're actually looking at is the contract of training rather than individual, because an apprenticeship is a contract of training with the employer. So when we do that, we get a certain rate. Now, there are some problems with that because there are a certain number of contracts of training for which we do not know the outcome, around about 5% of those. And therefore, our official completion rate slightly understates any true rate. But what people say is when we present this data is that we've missed out on an important element, which is that some individuals get a new contract of training because they change employers, and so they do finish their apprenticeship. And the thing I was particularly interested in was to see how much difference that makes. Now, we collect data on these people. There's a recommencement flag that we use in our data set, and this enables me to get some idea of the extent of what I would call churn between employers. And it turns out to be quite important, certainly for apprentices overall. The churn rate is around about 25%. And that means that our official contract completion rate of, say, 46% understates the extent to which individuals finish their training. It doesn't understate the contract completion rate, but does understate the rate which individuals complete at. And so if you make this sort of adjustment, then the completion rate goes up to the mid-50, so around 57% or so.
And that's the average overall trade. So there's some discrepancies trade by trade?
That's one of the things I'm particularly interested in, is the variation across trades. And so we find there really are some quite a huge amount of variation. So in the food trades and the hairdressers, for example, the churn rate is over 40%. And this means that the proportions who actually complete apprenticeships are much greater for the individual than what they are for the contract. But even here, that doesn't necessarily lead to particularly high completion rates. So for the hairdressers, for example, taking that into account, their completion rate goes up to around about 50%. Better than certainly the estimate for the contracts, but still not particularly high. For the foods, again, it makes a difference, but their completion rate only goes up to 40%. So we're still looking at some occupations with very low completion rates.
What do we do with this light that shed on employer churn? What does it mean for policymakers and training providers?
Well, when we look at the reasons that people don't complete their apprenticeship, it's quite clear that the employment relationship is absolutely key. Therefore, employers and our policymakers really have to think about ways of making that relationship better. Other data that we're looking at shed some light on this. One of the things we're interested in is the relationship between the size of the employer and the completion rates. And what we typically find is that in almost all occupations, with one exception which I'll come to, employers who have more than 25 apprentices have much higher completion rates than those who only have a handful. And this presumably reflects the type of workplaces that they're in, the type of systems that the companies have, and all sorts of things like that. The implication is that we really do need to think about the relationship within small employers and think about how we can make that work better, because that seems to be where a lot of the problem is. I said there was one exception, and that's the construction trades. In the construction trades, it doesn't seem to make much difference to the completion rate whether you have only a handful of apprentices or whether you have large numbers of them.
Are we picking up something about the way businesses are run in the food and the hairdressing sectors that leads to this propensity to employer churn?
Well, if you look at those two trades, I think one of the overriding characteristics is really the workplace and the size of the business. Hairdressing salons, for example, tend to be fairly small, so they don't have big systems in place. They wouldn't have a training officer, for example. Also, in small workplaces, I suspect the personal relationships become perhaps magnified compared to bigger workplaces. That may make a difference. I suspect you find similar things in the food trades, where the workplaces do tend to be small rather than large.
Mm-hmm. Also, with the larger employer, when there are more employees together doing an apprenticeship, maybe there's a collegiate sense of support as they're going through the system together that might help.
I think that's right, but not totally. I'm sure some of these companies just have better systems. They have people who look after these things. They design their programs and so on. But of course, some very large employers do have distributed workplaces. And so I don't think we can necessarily assume that all the reasons just because there's a decent sized cohort of apprentices. In some companies, it may well be the case that they've got large numbers of apprentices, but they're spread round.
So what's your advice to us now, next time we see the official completion rates for apprenticeships? How do we read them? How do we interpret them?
Well, they need to be interpreted as they are. They are correct, but they do relate to the contracts of training. They do understate the rates that apply to individuals. But we shouldn't use that to come to a conclusion that it isn't an issue here, that the completion rates are satisfactory. Even after we make these types of adjustments, we find that overall the completion rates aren't that high. But perhaps more importantly, we see that there's this huge variation across occupations, across employers. So we've really got to worry about those areas where it's clearly not working that well.
Erica, I'd like to turn to you now, if I may, and return to this notion, or at least begin with the notion of employer churn raised by Tom, where apprentices or trainees leave one employer for another during their training period, because to me it raises questions about loyalty and good faith on one hand, and it also speaks to the fragility of these arrangements. In particular, it says to me that it's foolhardy to assume that just because an employer and employee set off on a path together, they'll both stay the course. So does your research into the psychological contracts between apprentices, trainees and their employers shed light on why some participants walk away from their obligations while others push through to the end, even when they encounter difficulties?
It does, but first of all, I must start by saying that we only researched apprentices and trainees that were still employed. When we talked to employers, they were talking about their experience with apprentices and trainees and would have had in mind people who'd left. But in terms of our work with apprentices and trainees, we were only looking at those that were still there. So we don't know why those people left, although one can infer it. But in general, our research it looked, as you say, at the psychological contract, at the which is about those unspoken expectations between the employer and the employee. And in the case of apprenticeships and traineeships, there's extra parties as well, including the training provider and other bodies, which makes it actually more complex. So what we examined was what were the expectations on both sides of the relationship, how important did each party think those expectations were, and then how far they thought they were met during the period of the apprenticeship and traineeship. Also, we looked at what happens when there was a breach in the employment relationship. So We ended up with a pretty good picture of what it was that people were looking for and what things it was that were prone to some difficulty and then some differences amongst different groups.
Well, let's look a little bit closer at these psychological contracts now. What do they look like, firstly, from an apprentice or a trainee point of view? What elements are involved from their perspective in this psychological contract?
The most important thing and the thing that differentiates an apprentice contract from an ordinary employer contract, psychological contract, is the expectation of training. And that's hardly surprising because that's a major component of apprenticeship. But that was up there as the most important obligation that the employer had towards the apprentice or trainee. And then there's a series of other obligations that people viewed as important, including things like giving them a job that they liked, giving them enough resources to do the work, and a range of other features. But the training was the most important thing from the apprentice point of view. From the employer point of view, the most important obligation of the apprentice and or trainee was things like attendance and punctuality. And then the second most important thing was that the apprentice would apply themselves to learning. So that learning training thing was really important. And another major expectation that we found was an emphasis on safety. Apprentice expected the employer to provide them with safe working conditions, and the employer expected the apprentice or trainee to work safely. And that hasn't been found in other psychological contract literature, so we feel it's something that's particularly drilled into apprentices and trainees, as it should be. So that was quite a comforting thought, really. Yeah.
I also noted you discovered there's actually not a lot written or discussed about the employer's perspective of these psychological contracts, more the other side.
Exactly. So most of the literature focuses on what employees expect of their employers, and so ours was a fairly unusual survey that we included both viewpoints. Yeah.
Erica, in your research you point out that a mismatch between the literacy and numeracy demands of the job, the training and the contract process, and the capabilities of the employee have a negative impact on retention rates. Do you believe that those mismatches have this effect because they put undue pressure on this psychological contract?
This wasn't a major focus of our research, but we certainly looked at it. And there's a general belief, I suppose, around apprenticeships and traineeships that literacy problems lead to dropout. Now, we didn't really find this very strongly in our research. We didn't find that literacy and numeracy were major issues on average. We felt, though, and this was a reasonably significant finding, that apprentices and trainees didn't think they had literacy problems. But on the other hand, employers thought that the problems were greater than the apprentices and trainees did, which suggests, it could suggest a number of things, but one thing it could suggest is that that apprentices and trainees don't understand the impact that maybe any deficiencies in literacy and numeracy might be having, but employers are more aware of them. But we certainly didn't really find any evidence to support the fact that it was a major issue. Those employers that knew that their cohorts of apprentices or trainees were likely to have some literacy deficiencies compensated for them, they had special programs in place and so on. So they were well aware of it. Yeah.
Returning more broadly now to the psychological contracts, and I assume the very nature of a psychological contract is that it is nebulous. It's held in thought. It's unwritten. If that's the case, how are they or can they be remembered during the life of a training contract And should they be formalised in some way?
So this is interesting because in theory, a psychological contract is just that. It's understood. But in practice, the more they're actually written down, the better. So we found that the employers who were really good at this side of managing apprentices or trainees actually did formalise them. They, you know, in some cases, they wrote them down or they were embodied in things like the company mission statement and values and that sort of thing, which the apprentices and trainees had drilled into them. And the mutual expectations were reinforced right through the apprenticeship and traineeship, and that actually started way back before they were even recruited. So when you look at the company's website or their other recruitment material, it's really clear what the expectations are, and the company's actually reinforced them even back with people like careers officers in schools and so on. So everybody knew as far as possible what the deal was, and then it was reinforced again at interview, at induction training and at performance management through the, you know, the job cycle. So they made them as explicit as possible. But that's not easy for an employer. And I think particularly if you're not a very experienced employer, to know how to do that without going over the top or without it seeming too oblique that people don't get it. So it's quite a complex thing for employers to do. Yeah.
So we have apprentices and trainees aware of this psychological contract that's intrinsic in their thoughts, employers too. What about the training providers? What should they make of this research? Is there a role for them to play with a sensitivity towards the existence of these psychological contracts?
I think that most training providers are well aware of this, but probably don't have the words to use to describe it. So I think the research in terms of speaking of it as a psychological contract will actually help them to conceptualise what they do, because what happens with training providers, some of the apprentices or trainees that they visit or that come into their classes will be clearly unhappy in their workplaces. And I know from many other research projects that part of what they do is try to smooth things over and work with the apprentice or trainee to say, you know, come on, it's not that bad, or how about this strategy or that strategy. So I think it's not that they don't understand the issues, but I think this research will help to give them the words and perhaps explain to them what things are more important to apprentices and trainees so that they can focus a bit more on them. But it's quite a delicate and sensitive issue when you're talking about a number of different bodies having responsibility in some way for an apprentice or trainee to make sure that people aren't treading on each other's toes. So we actually found in our research that, for example, group training organisations, which are sometimes a party to the training contract, actually have formalised agreements with the other parties, with the employers and the training providers, and they're actually written down, the contract, as to what each party will do, which actually makes everything clearer all around.
Yeah. Finally, I wonder if we could elaborate a little on the topic of pastoral care, because in your report, you note a discrepancy between survey and case study phases on this topic, namely that the case studies refer to a great many incidents of pastoral care by employers, while in the survey, providing support with personal problems was rated low by both employers and apprentices alike. Can you explain this?
It was a very interesting finding, and there were actually a couple of items in the survey. It wasn't just the one, but like a small cluster of items that reflected what we might think of as pastoral care, and they were all rated as not very important. And yet when we went to do the case studies, the employers particularly, not so much the employees, but sometimes, talked a lot about it. They were very proud of the work that they did in pastoral care, in helping with personal problems and so on. So what does that mean? It's interesting, isn't it? Maybe it means that the work that employers are doing is not so important as they think it is as in that area, and maybe they could be focusing more energy on other parts of the psychological contract. Or maybe it even means that it's sort of taken for granted that they do that, and when people came to fill the survey in, they just assumed that, look, who knows? I don't know, but I think it deserves a bit more exploration, particularly, I think, in view of the fact that it is a matter that's so much discussed in policy circles and in practice. If we're spending a lot of effort on something that maybe isn't so vital, then that's perhaps a bit of a waste of resources. But that's in no way denigrating the important work that these people do. It is very important, but it's worth a second look, I think.
And also talks to the benevolence at the heart of the psychological contract on both sides.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, employers put an incredible amount of personal effort in, and they're often really committed to the point of being quite zealous in their management of apprentices and trainees, especially the younger ones. And sometimes maybe they would do it even if it wasn't necessary, because they just feel it's part of what they want to give to young people and to the Australian workforce.
Well, let's turn from the pastoral care at the personal level to the sector-wide yearning for all participants in vocational education and training to be successful. And one such attempt to improve outcomes for all has been the development of pre-apprenticeships, a practice that seems to have begun in the early 20th century. The thinking behind pre-apprenticeships is that they can improve completion rates and achieve higher satisfaction ratings among apprentices and trainees. Damien, you and Tom looked into these programs. Did you find any evidence to suggest they're succeeding?
Well, we found some evidence that pre-apprenticeships are having a positive impact, but the impact was far from universal. So if we looked first of all at satisfaction, we found that pre-apprenticeships did have a small positive impact on the satisfaction with the on-the-job elements associated with an apprenticeship. But the impact was very small, especially in comparison to the other factors. We also looked at the impact on completion rates, so the likelihood of an apprentice finishing their training. And there we found a mixed picture. So for some occupations and for some highest school levels, there was a positive impact. Pre-apprenticeships were doing the job that they're meant to do. But it was also the case that when we looked at some other occupations and levels of education, pre-apprenticeships actually appeared to do more harm than good.
We'll look at that in just a moment, but I suppose we should begin with a definition of pre-apprenticeships. Is there a formal definition? What are their hallmarks?
Well, there's a bit of definitional ambiguity about what is a pre-apprenticeship. If we take a relatively broad, encompassing definition, we can say that a pre-apprenticeship or a pre-vocational course, that's another term that's used, is any activity that's designed to prepare someone to enter into an apprenticeship.
Some people, I see, refer to them almost as traineeships by another name. Is that fair?
No, there's been, I suppose, a change over time, particularly once traineeships were introduced in the mid-90s, they got a lot of attention from policymakers as one means of assisting young people who perhaps were otherwise disadvantaged into the labour force. So they've really diverged in that sense.
So let's turn now to the outcomes of these pre-apprenticeships. You were talking about some of the outcomes. Who do they help the most?
Well, I suppose there's two ways of answering that question. The first way is that pre-apprenticeships are often targeted towards disadvantaged groups. And when we look at who does a pre-apprenticeship, we see that, for example, people from Indigenous backgrounds are much more likely to undertake a pre-apprenticeship, for example. And that's because pre-apprenticeships are thought to give people an introduction to the trade that perhaps they haven't otherwise been exposed to, and also provide them with any sort of remedial assistance, whether that's to do with numeracy or literacy or more general employability skills. So that's the theory. In practice, we found that pre-apprenticeships were working well for some occupations, particularly the construction trades, the food trades, interestingly, and the electrical trades, most particularly, but that they were also not having the intended effect in some of the other trades, especially the automotive and engineering trades and hairdressing.
Aside from trades, is it fair to say there are some people for whom pre-apprenticeships might be wasted on or work against their success?
Apprenticeships in the construction and electrical were fine, but in the automotive and engineering trades, but particularly in the hairdressing trades, pre-apprenticeships actually reduced the likelihood of completing an apprenticeship, which was a surprising and somewhat disconcerting finding.
And why was that?
We don't know. is this simple and direct answer. We use data from the Apprenticeship Destination Survey, a survey conducted by NCVER in 2010, and we've got limited information on the actual pre-apprenticeship or pre-vocational course that the student undertook. So we can only speculate that it might be to do with the curriculum, the way that it's the way that they're targeted at certain individuals, or the way that the pre-apprenticeship might relate to the apprenticeship. And there I mean factors like whether or not the apprentice gets credit for the work that they did in the pre-apprenticeship, and whether the term of their apprenticeship is reduced in recognition of the work that they've already done in the pre-apprenticeship.
And does the level of education that a participant might already hold have any bearing on the effect or otherwise of a pre-apprenticeship?
Yes, we did find an effect for level of education. So if you have completed Year 12 or you've completed Year 10, then a pre-apprenticeship has the intended effect and does increase slightly, but does increase the likelihood of completing the apprenticeship. However, if before starting the apprenticeship you already held a Certificate 3 qualification or some other higher qualification, then a pre-apprenticeship wasn't going to help you improve the odds of you completing that apprenticeship. And the same was also true, interestingly, for people who left school at Year 11. So if you left school at Year 11, doing a pre-apprenticeship didn't improve the likelihood of completing an apprenticeship.
So what should policymakers make of these findings around pre-apprenticeships?
Well, the main conclusion is that the design of pre-apprenticeships is very important and can't be taken for granted. And because we have found these effects for occupation and also for highest level of education, it means that when policymakers sit down to design the curriculum of pre-apprenticeships and also how they relate to the apprenticeship, so how they connect together, those are two factors that really need to be borne in mind.
Damien, can we dig a little deeper into perhaps some of the reasons why people who only completed Year 11 or have previous certificates don't tend to get the outcome from pre-apprenticeships that others might?
In the case of people who leave school in Year 11, we can speculate that unlike people who leave school at Year 10, probably do so quite determined to take on an apprenticeship. So they're highly motivated. And likewise, people who finished Year 12 show some evidence of being willing to stick at something and complete it. Whereas Year 11, it means you leave school sort of in the middle of something. And so there is already that sort of record of not completing things and not sticking at things. So perhaps that's the factor there. In the case of people with higher qualification, so a Certificate 3 or above, the explanation might not be so straightforward, but it seems that it could be the case that if you have a higher qualification, you're not necessarily going to benefit from what a pre-apprenticeship is designed to do, and that is sort of provide an introduction and provide those remedial skills.
Do we know much about expectations of participants and how that bears upon the efficacy or otherwise of a pre-apprenticeship?
Well, Erica actually looked a little bit at this in her work on the psychological contract. And what a pre-apprenticeship can do is increase expectations both of what the apprentice themselves is required to give, and it might also lower expectations of what the apprentice expects from the employer.
I note that policymakers and others in this system tend to look upon pre-apprenticeships quite favourably. How should they take your findings? How should that affect their attitudes towards pre-apprenticeships going forward? Should this dull some of that enthusiasm?
I think the lesson from this research is that pre-apprenticeships in and of themselves are not necessarily a good thing. Pre-apprenticeships can do their job well if they're designed well. And trying to unlock those factors of what makes a good pre-apprenticeship is the challenge for policymakers if they are looking to expand the pre-apprenticeship model.
I'd also add the point there that in designing the pre-apprenticeships, policymakers need to be very cognizant of the group that they're looking at. And the sort of design that might work for one group is not going to work for another group.
So trade-specific?
Trade-specific, but also to do with the characteristics of the individual, their education levels, their age, other factors such as that.
Thanks for listening to this podcast produced by the National Centre for Vocational Education Research. For further information about this work, go to www.ncver.edu.au.